you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
Start your Saturday with something that will grow your kiddos' brains and get their creative juices flowing. Join us at LAS in Pasadena for a morning of multilingual readings, interactive performances, and lots of kid fun. It's Super Fun Saturday on June 1st. Get your tickets at las.com/events.
From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. The economic forecast for California, well, one group of smart people say it's gearing up to be a euphoric rebound. But what has to happen for a clean, hiccup-free California comeback? We'll dive in on State of Affairs. Plus, the Mars rover has been on the red planet for over 100 days, and NASA's next big mission? Yeah, just heading over to Venus. We'll talk about it. I head on Take Two. Stay with us.
The LAS Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAS.com/sweeps.
LAist has a new live event series with the James Beard Foundation. We Are Where We Eat will go behind the scenes of some of your favorite LA restaurants to find out how and why they do what they do. I'm Austin Cross. Join me for the first event where we'll explore how restaurants help make a neighborhood and we'll all have something delicious to eat afterwards. It's May 22nd at the Crawford. Get your tickets now at las.com/events.
From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. Thanks for doing Friday with us. Coming up.
You have to smash your life to go. I smashed my own life and dropped it all.
We continue our series, Pushed Out, examining why so many survivors of domestic abuse end up homeless. Nikki's story is just ahead. But first, it's State of Affairs, our weekly dive into California's politics pool. Now, the weather forecast for the weekend in LA is sunny and in the 70s. Pretty ideal, right? But maybe not as great as the economic forecast for the state. And that's because the UCLA Anderson forecast says California is set for a, quote, euphoric rebound. And it appears that Governor Gavin Newsom does not want us to forget that. We'll get into that more this week with Carla Marinucci, political senior writer and of California Playbook. Carla, welcome back.
Thanks to be with you.
Also with us, Jack Pitney, Claremont McKenna College professor and author of Un-American, The Fake Patriotism of Donald J. Trump. Jack, welcome to you as well.
Good afternoon.
All right, it comes out every quarter, but this time the timing of UCLA's Anderson forecasts could have inadvertently felt like a press release from the governor's office. The quote from UCLA senior economist, "We are about to have one of the best years of economic growth that we have had since World War II." Carla, before we get into the specific slices of the economy in California, in general, why is this guy so optimistic?
Well, you know, California had some big numbers. It was hit very hard by COVID, you know, almost 4 million COVID cases and 64,000 deaths. But it's the nation's most populous state, and it looked like California did do more than a few things right during the pandemic. The UCLA team said that overall, California's measure to protect the big swaths of the economy really helped set the stage for a faster recovery than the nation as a whole. And Governor Gavin Newsom said it today at his press conference. California has done 38 million vaccinations. That's almost twice as many as any other state. And the current low infection rate means that the UCLA economist said that the business restrictions are going to be easing. The state's going to fully reopen on June 15th. Newsom said yesterday in San Francisco that 38% of all the new jobs in the country originate in California, as do most of the IPOs. And so the one big takeaway, I think, was that the economist found that despite those apocalyptic stories and Elon Musk, there really was no mass exodus from California. People are not leaving. It was really about the pandemic. So, yes, Newsom has been touting this since it happened, says California is roaring back, and he's going to keep saying that.
You know, John Cox's TV commercials still say Elon Musk left California. I wonder why he didn't go back and fix that. That's another topic for another day. One quote that I thought was really funny from a chief economist from Bank of the West, Scott Anderson: consumers flush with an appetite to spend like a sailor on furlough will drive the economy. That would be very much good for California, Jack. But let me ask you this, Jack Pitney. Is this one of those things where any sign of growth will look just massive, considering how dire things have been in California? I mean, we really cratered out.
Oh, yeah. Compared with where we were about a year ago, you're right. Any growth would look great. But California actually did better than a lot of other states. Our economic output shrank less than for the United States as a whole. You know, for those of you who are Seinfeld fans, shrinkage was a big deal last year.
It was only in the pool, by the way. There. That's, go ahead, Jack. Sorry.
But the K-shaped recovery is a real thing. In California, affluent people have done fine. During the pandemic, they could work from home, no sweat. And the value of their stock market holdings went up unexpectedly. People who own stocks did great. Other people who had to show up to work, people who had to work with their hands, they didn't do quite so well. So overall, the picture is good, but there's darkness amid the light.
Now, okay, California's unemployment rate is higher than the rest of the nation, and is expected to stay that way. So, Carla, how does this rosy outlook square with that particular fact?
Yeah, you know, as you mentioned, I mean, we're still above the average. The state's unemployment rate is around almost a bit at 6% compared with 4.5 for the U.S. as a whole. Look, tourism is a very big deal in California, and tech and international trade. Those are areas that are going to come back slower, but they're coming back. The economist said that those ships are lined up outside the ports in Long Beach and L.A. and Oakland. So the state is better prepared than most to rebound. The issue here is that California has a younger population on the whole than most states. So the unemployment rate is expected to remain high. Probably by 2023, they're saying, is there going to be the real comeback from the pandemic, where joblessness in California could be about back to 4%. And that's just about where it's going to be in the U.S. by that time.
And I think, Carla, theme parks are getting close to or right at the point of allowing out-of-state visitors to show up. So I think, yeah, that might be another big point to pay attention to when all this starts working back in that direction. All right, so let's get now to how the economy will all do, considering that tourists are not exactly flocking back to California yet because the pandemic isn't over. What part, Jack, let's start with you on this. What part of the Anderson forecast's positive outlook jumped out the most to you?
The emphasis on the information sector, which wasn't a thing all that long ago, but now it is central to the economy. And not only did it not suffer from the shutdown, it actually benefited. One datum says it all. Zoom is headquartered in San Jose.
Oh, yeah.
And during the pandemic, everybody was using Zoom. And after the pandemic, a lot more people are going to continue using it than used it before.
Yeah. Carla, what about you? You mentioned the ports, too. The ships are lined up at the ports just waiting.
Tourism is one thing, but I got to say restaurants. I was with Gavin Newsom yesterday in San Francisco when he announced that extension.
Not at the French Laundry, were you?
Yes, right. No. He was at Tommy's Mexican restaurant, very well-known margarita center in San Francisco, talking about the to-go cocktails and the parklets, and basically saying, look, the restaurant business in California, that was the biggest producer of sales tax in California. 60% of businesses are owned by people of color. Those restaurant businesses are family businesses. So the idea that these are coming back now, the parklets are going to remain. Those have changed the culture in cities like LA and San Francisco. Newsom said, eat your heart out, Paris. These outside places are here to stay in California. And so that's kind of one big aspect of the California economy. They employ millions here in California. And I think the restaurant folks are very, very happy that those are some of the changes that are coming around the pike now.
Well, speaking of Gavin Newsom, now the embargoed forecast was released 1 a.m. Wednesday morning. By 7:36 in the morning, Gavin Newsom tweeted, the California comeback is here. And in classic California style, it's outpacing the nation. Carla, so what part of this rosy outlook can Newsom take credit for?
Well, you know, there's always a debate over how much the chief executive can take credit. Yeah. He gets the blame, too. But the bottom line is, in California, remember, the stimulus checks went out, an extra $600 to those making under $75,000, an additional $500 for those with kids. And, you know, Newsom talked about this today, saying that in Republican states where they're considering eliminating unemployment insurance, where they want to cut back on some of that stimulus, or they didn't support the federal government's plans. He said that is politics, not economics. And he Newsom said today that California is going to stay the course on those kind of supplemental unemployment insurance benefits. In other words, he gets the credit for fighting, I think, to put those checks out to people. And some economists say that did help stimulate the economy. It did create a movement here in California.
Jack, what about you? Do you see any direct A to B between Newsom did this and California benefited? How?
Sure. Carl is absolutely right. Stimulus worked. The lockdowns worked. We did better than a lot of other states. But it's not just what the government did. Some of our economic strength is accidental. You know, we have a huge tech sector in part because Bill Hewlett and David Packard went to Stanford. If they'd gone to Georgia Tech, we'd be talking about the Silicon Peach Orchard. I mean, so it's a mix of government policy and things that are beyond the reach of government.
It was Branch Rickey, the general manager of the Brooklyn Dodgers, who said, "Luck is the residue of design." One of my favorite quotes of all time, because, yeah, sometimes you do get lucky in a lot of things, but if you have a good plan, then the luck kind of slides your way.
Yeah,
State of Affairs with Politico's Carla Marinucci and Claremont McKenna College professor Jack Pitney. Now, Newsom took to the stage today to reveal the first winners of his Vax for the Win lottery to encourage people to get vaccinated. Carla, how did that go today?
Well, if you took in the gold lamé curtain behind him, that Wheel of Fortune behind him, the confetti cannons that went off at the end, Bob Barker and Monty Hall had nothing on Gavin Newsom today. He was out there acting the game show host. And I think taking a sort of a victory lap here, basically saying, look, they need to get more Californians vaccinated. And yes, you know, all 15 winners were from coastal or Bay Area counties, including a couple from L.A., Orange County, San Diego, making the point that that's where the higher vaccination rates are and that Californians need to get vaccinated. Now, whether this vaccination incentive program is going to work, we still have to see. They're hoping that today's lottery, which $50,000 to 15 winners are going to happen altogether, that's going to get people out there to get the shots in the arm. Right now, he wants to get about 85% of Californians vaccinated. Newsom said yesterday that's going to be a hard lift, but boy, if this money doesn't get people into it, I'm not sure what will.
You know, the coolest thing about Bob Barker was, Carla, is that long, thin microphone that he used. Remember, it wasn't like a normal kind of stout microphone. It was that long, oh, it looks so cool. Okay, but tweets that caught my attention about this were not about the lottery. It's about him saying that the emergency designation would not be lifted on June 15th. Carla, this confused a lot of people. So what does exactly does it mean, and how does it have any bearing on the full reopening of California?
Yeah, well, remember that, you know, Newsom has touted next Tuesday as the landmark in California's, fight over the pandemic. The comeback is not going to be an entirely a comeback in the sense that he's going to maintain the official state of emergency after June 15th. And essentially that gives him the powers to sort of flex his executive muscles. He's been doing that. The Republicans don't like this at all. They're already out there tweeting about this, saying that he is overstepping his boundaries. This is dictatorial overreach, and they have reacted with frustration on this. But bottom line is, the emergency, he said, remains in effect after June 15th because we are still in a state of emergency. The disease has not been extinguished. So I think more to come on that, more details to come, Newsom's got the power, executive power, and Republicans are chafing at that.
And Jack, because we always have the recall in our rearview mirror, did today's appearance benefit Newsom or did it hurt him at all?
To be determined. As Carla said, the ambiguity about the reopening could potentially be a problem for him. If he doesn't reimpose any restrictions, he's fine. People are expecting California to open on June 15th. But if he hits the dimmer switch as he did in the middle of summer last year, then he has a huge political problem because the expectations are so high. So that will be a constraint on him going forward.
And guys, is it just me, but does Newsom get in his own way on the recall? I mean, the French Laundry, I mean, this ambiguity, it just seems like if there's someone that is in a weird way, an energizer for the recall effort, it's him sometimes. Or is it Carla? What do you mean?
I mean, certainly, I think you're right. A lot of the problems he's had have been of his own making. But at this point, the Republicans are really having a tough time getting any traction against him with the economy coming back and the pandemic waning. Yeah. This is their biggest challenge. As Jack said, though, things can change. It's California.
All right. One more thing, because with things opening back up and people going out and doing fun stuff, the next big thing will be how and when Californians will head back in to work with or without masks. Carla, really quick, what did Cal OSHA decide on?
Yeah, I mean, the big takeaway is that workplace safety rules are going to be relaxed on June 15th, and you can ditch that mask, but only if you work in a place where everyone is vaccinated. The masks are not going to be required outside, except at mega events like with 10,000 or more big concerts and so forth. Workers who are indoors still have to stay at least 6 feet apart until July 31st, even if they're vaccinated. So this may go to exactly what Jack said, some frustration among Californians, not understanding what the rules are. And so it could get a little dicey here in terms of the political turf for Newsom as he's going to effect.
Yeah, as Carla said, Jack, this, on the surface, Cal OSHA's recommendation sounds simple enough, but I mean, is there anything in it that could make things sticky somehow?
Yeah, expectations, enforcement. What happens if it's a fairly large workplace and there is this one guy who refuses to be vaccinated and everybody else has to keep on the masks? That's going to create a great deal of workplace friction, and that in turn could create political problems for Newsom.
All right, that's Jack Pitney, Claremont McKenna College professor, author of The Politics of Autism and also Un-American, The Fake Patriotism of Donald J. Trump, and also Carla Marinucci, political senior writer for the California Playbook. Carla, Jack, have a great weekend.
Good to be with you, A. Thanks.
You too.
All right, coming up, we're going to continue our series that we've been doing this week called Pushed Out. That's where we look into exploring why domestic or intimate partner violence is one of the biggest causes for women experiencing homelessness in LA County. That's coming up when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Tracy Thomas, host of One for the Books, and we are back for another round.
This is clearly an NPR audience.
Yeah, I think they're so smart. What the hell?
My guests this time are actor Vella Lavelle and author Amanda Montell, whose new book, The Age of Magical Overthinking, is out now. Join us on May 15th at the Crawford Family Forum for book talk, trivia, and hot takes. Tickets can be found at laist.com/events.
As a farmer's son from a desert region in California, J.B. Hamby thinks a lot about water.
I spent a lot of time digging up history, particularly about water, which is the origins of the Imperial Valley.
How this 28-year-old became the youngest lead negotiator on the Colorado River ever, and how he could shape the most consequential negotiations to date. Listen to Imperfect Paradise, the Gen Z water dealmaker, wherever you get podcasts.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. Ami Martinez. In our series Pushed Out, we continue exploring why domestic or intimate partner violence is the biggest reason women experience homelessness in LA County. Now, in her own words, survivor and advocate Nikki Brown tells the story of having to leave her own apartment and all of her possessions behind to escape 10 years of domestic abuse.
a lot of things that happen when you're in one of these relationships where it's about coercion and control, it's hard to see and it's hard to admit, right? Like, I've got a whole bunch of degrees. I'm a professional. I'm not supposed to be in this situation, is what people think. And honestly, it's what I thought. So it creeps up on you. You don't quite realize what you're into until you're deep in it. And then you don't want to admit it. I didn't want to admit it. He would undermine or verbally abuse or make fun of me. I'm not smart enough. I'm not thin enough. I'm not good enough. Or he'd have machetes and swords all around the house and make these jokes about how easy it would be to decapitate me with one. This woman says, "You're a battered woman." And I was like, "No, I'm not. I'm not that person." And I was mad at her because I didn't want to be that person. In late March 2017, I was going to go camping with my friend who goes camping every year. And I was just never going to go back home. My apartment, my lease, my responsibility, all my belongings, I was just not going to go home. It's hard to realize you need to leave, and then when you need to leave, you have to smash your life to go. I smashed my own life. Dropped it all. The plan was that I would couch surf for a few weeks and just recover, but that didn't work really well, right? Like, I got laid off the following month, so I didn't have an income. But the huge benefit of getting laid off was he couldn't follow me to my job because, you know, he would pop up at my job and just be there. One day when I got to work, he was under my desk. But getting laid off set me free. The interesting thing about experiencing homelessness is that you don't quite expect it to be what it is. The only reason I got into this pretty awesome homeless shelter because a friend of a friend of a friend said, "Hey, there's a bed here." And I don't know, there's something about asking for that, saying, "Yes, I'm going to go to a shelter," that takes you down a peg or two, right? Because we all tell a story to ourselves that this couldn't ever possibly be us. And that was the moment. I was like, okay, this is me now. End of August, I found this apartment in Inglewood. So I was really lucky because rents are ridiculous in LA and I was still on unemployment. I found this woman who was doing an internship in New York, also a survivor, I learned, who just wanted somebody to cover her mortgage. It does a number on you. I took a job where I could only work like 2 days a week because I'd just be exhausted and sickened and scared to drive too far away from my house. And just slowly but surely, I did more. Like, I worked a little more. You know, I figured out how to get through a whole day. I started walking more than the 3 blocks around my apartment. Stopped cringing every time I heard a really loud car stereo because it sounded like them coming to get me. Just slowly started to come back to myself. I'm still recovering. Sometimes I'm deeply frustrated with myself. I'm like, you need to be better. Your brain needs to work better and faster. But it's healing. It probably will be for the rest of my life.
That's Nikki Brown, a survivor who experienced homelessness when escaping 10 years of domestic abuse. She's now a legal aid attorney and an advocate for survivors. This piece was produced by Take-Two's Julia Paskin as part of our ongoing series on the link between domestic violence and homelessness called Pushed Out. Moving on, earlier this week, we told you about Angelenos living in unpermitted apartments. They faced eviction during the pandemic. And despite the city knowing about unsafe conditions in their building for years, they're still waiting for help relocating. In fact, city records show that last year, enforcement against illegal housing in LA took a nosedive. KPCC's David Wagner has that story.
Housing advocates say during the pandemic, the city has been slow in responding to the needs of people who feel stranded in unpermitted housing. Natalie Medina is an attorney with the Eviction Defense Network.
There has been virtually no support.
One of her clients was seeking relocation assistance last year, but he first needed a city inspector to come out and confirm his unit was illegal.
And nobody would come for months. He just kind of sat there in bad conditions, and there wasn't a law that we could use effectively to get him what he needed.
KPCC obtained inspection data from the city's housing department. We reviewed 10 years' worth of records and found violations associated with unpermitted housing peaked at more than 2,700 in 2019. But last year, citations plummeted by more than two-thirds. Many violations involve people living in garages, laundry rooms, and illegally subdivided apartments. A smaller number don't involve tenants, such as unpermitted storage spaces, but many other cases involve permitted apartments being used in unpermitted ways, like small units with unapproved kitchen appliances.
The conditions you see in illegal units are almost as a rule worse than they are in legal units.
Medina, the eviction attorney, says these conditions can be dangerous.
Sometimes they don't have kitchens. There are no smoke detectors. There often are electrical problems that can start fires. There can be loss of life in those situations.
We reached out to the city's housing department to ask what happened. A spokesperson says inspections were suspended at various points last year due to public health concerns, but as things get closer to normal, inspections have resumed with COVID-19 precautions in place. The city's Department of Building and Safety says it also suspended enforcement of certain quality of life violations during the pandemic. Housing rights advocates say they understand why the city has been hesitant about inspections during a pandemic, but they say in many cases, the lack of enforcement has left tenants to fend for themselves.
We have seen a dramatic increase in illegal lockouts and utility shutoffs.
Trinidad Ocampo is an eviction attorney with Neighborhood Legal Services of LA County. She says tenants in illegal housing often get shuffled between different departments and problems don't get fixed. Ocampo says during the pandemic, she's seen
an increase in time to get inspections completed or reports or compliance orders prepared.
Unpermitted housing is very common in the city of LA.
Vineet Mukhija is a UCLA professor of urban planning who does research on informal housing. He says people end up in illegal units because public housing assistance is extremely limited, and LA wages haven't kept up with skyrocketing rents for legal units. The bottom line, he says, is many don't have a choice.
I'm sure if people had a choice, they would live in safe, excellent, well-located housing. But in a context where they don't have choices, I suspect they're living wherever they can find housing they can afford.
Experts say in a city with rising homelessness, enforcement needs to focus on keeping people housed. Shutting down illegal units isn't always the answer, but neither is leaving tenants to languish in unsafe conditions. Miguel Roman is one of the tenants who faced eviction from an unpermitted mid-city building last year.
It seems like the ceiling has to be falling on top of you in order for them to actually do something. There's insects in here, there's mold everywhere. That's not enough.
Problems with bootleg apartments aren't new for the city. In fact, the city created a program 4 years ago to bring illegal units up to code and give owners a path to legalization. But the results haven't been what lawmakers expected. Here's what happened. Back in 2017, local politicians were not happy with how the city was handling these units. City Councilman Paul Caretz says at the time, the housing department was shutting down hundreds of low-cost units every year and kicking tenants out.
We were essentially finding permanently, naturally occurring affordable housing and doing our best to ruin it.
Caretz pushed for the passage of a program that gives bootleg apartment owners a streamlined way to bring units up to code and get amnesty. The city saw this program as a win-win for landlords and tenants. Landlords avoid legal trouble, and tenants get to stay in an affordable unit. When it passed 4 years ago, Caretz hoped the program would preserve a lot of affordable housing in a city that desperately needs it. Today, he says,
it's been a completely worthless program. It's even more ineffective than I had realized.
The city's planning department told KPCC that only 39 apartments have been approved for occupancy so far. Caretz thinks property owners are scared off by a rule that units must be kept affordable under a 55-year covenant. He plans to introduce a motion getting rid of that requirement.
There's no need for a covenant in these units.
He says they're less desirable units to begin with, so rents will naturally stay low.
My intention is to remove the covenant requirement, which I think will pull everyone in.
Dan Uchelson with the Apartment Association of Greater Los Angeles agrees that the 55-year covenant is a huge barrier.
There's literally thousands of these units that could be brought into compliance with the city if they did not impose such restrictive covenants.
Greg Spiegel with the Inner City Law Center says getting rid of the affordability covenant would only reward landlords who chose to break the law.
There would be no consequence for their bad actions of building an illegal unit.
Spiegel says participation could probably be improved with better awareness.
There are so many things one could do to evaluate a program about how well it's marketed before you gut it and make it a giveaway to people who are acting illegally.
There may be other barriers to participation. UCLA urban planning professor Vineet Mukhija says bootleg apartment owners may not have enough resources to bring these units up to code.
It might also be necessary for the city to be willing to spend money, perhaps in the form of loans, to bring units that are somewhat substandard into compliance.
Mukhija says the low participation highlights how hard it is to bring informal housing out of the shadows.
I am very happy that instead of shutting down the units, the city is trying to preserve them, but this is a difficult task.
Dan Uchelson with the Apartment Association says many property owners have given up on the city's program. Instead, they're now adding units to their buildings through recent changes in state law.
People are building accessory dwelling units because they're basically allowed to build them by right.
It's not clear how many existing bootleg apartments are being legalized through state law. While policymakers debate why only 39 units have been legalized under the city's program, tenants living in unpermitted units say they're fed up with the city's crushing rents. Last year, Kamisha Nafaretti faced eviction from an unpermitted apartment in LA's mid-city neighborhood. She says once she's able to finally move out, she's leaving LA for good.
I grew up in California. I'm from California. There's no place like this to me. I just can't afford it.
Covering the economy, I'm David Wagner.
This story was produced as part of a data fellowship through the USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism. There has been a lot of space in the news lately, literally a lot of news about outer space. The Mars rover has been, well, roving around Mars for over 100 days now. We're seeing pictures of dust devils, mysterious rocks, fake rainbows, and NASA's next big mission? No biggie, just heading over to check out Venus. It's coming up when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Start your Saturday with something that will grow your kiddos' brains and get their creative juices flowing. Join us at LAS for a morning of multilingual story times, interactive performances, art making, and lots of kid fun. Bring the whole fam and join us for a super fun Saturday at LAS in Pasadena on June 1st. Tickets at las.com/events. See you there.
Harole is your connection to Los Angeles. Get to know its history.
The 1920s were a huge boom time in Los Angeles, and downtown was just exploding.
Its politics.
It's the biggest local prosecutor's office in the country.
And its food.
Korean spices with like a hint of sweetness.
And just everything we love about LA. Subscribe to How to LA from LA Studios wherever you listen to podcasts.
As long as we both shall live. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org. I'm E. Martinez. Some call it the morning star, others the evening star, and some even call it Earth's evil twin. I'm, of course, talking about the planet just one step closer to the sun than Earth, and that's Venus. This week, NASA sent astronomers and space geeks just like me into a feverish excitement with the announcement of not one, but two new spacecraft missions to study the second planet from the sun. They plan to examine Venus's atmosphere and geological features in a series of dual missions due to launch between 2028 and 2030. Now, here to help us dissect the implications of such a groundbreaking planetary exploration, I'm joined by Bruce Betts, chief scientist and LightSail program manager for the Planetary Society, the world's largest space interest group. Bruce, it's been a long time. Welcome back.
It has. Good to be back.
Now, NASA last went to Venus in 1990, I believe. So why now with the revisit?
Well, the concrete answer is that these two missions won a competition, a regular competition called the Discovery Mission Selection, and that NASA runs. And these were shown to have the highest science value, and also NASA thought they could actually accomplish those things. The more general answer is there's been a lot of technological and improvements since Magellan in 1990, and there's a lot more you can do with Venus now based upon the technology research that's been done in the meantime.
And it's there, right, Bruce? So why not go take a look at it? I mean, that's the way. It's not as simple as that, I know, but, you know.
It's an interesting place. Yeah. It's a hellhole, but it's our hellhole next door.
It is. Okay, so we know a little bit about Venus, but certainly not as much as we know about other planets like Mars. So what do we know about Venus other than it just being a hellhole?
We know a lot of stuff. There have been various spacecraft missions, Earth observations. So we know that Venus has a very, very thick atmosphere, very high surface pressure. So the pressure on the surface is like the pressure 3,000 feet under the surface of the ocean on Earth. So it's more like a submarine environment than what we think of as an atmosphere. But wait, don't order yet. It has a runaway greenhouse that has lifted its surface temperature to about 900 degrees Fahrenheit, hot enough to melt lead and just not friendly. But wait, I can give you even more. It's got sulfuric acid clouds. Ooh. Just to make things extra pleasant. Higher up in the atmosphere.
So like Superman's the only one.
Interesting geology. Yeah.
Superman's the only one.
Superman hung out there for a while.
Yeah. That'd be the only thing that could go visit it. So I'm going to ask, considering what you said about how deadly the place is, I'm going to ask the dumb question here, Bruce. Life on Venus, is it possible that it could have existed or exists today? Is that just nuts?
It's possible. Probably it's not as likely as elsewhere, but let's take first, could it have existed?
Yeah.
There could have been liquid water oceans early in Venus history. Liquid water is one of the few things that's required by all life on Earth. But Venus lost those oceans early on if they existed. And since then, certainly any kind of life we know couldn't exist down on the very dry, very hot surface. So the one place that scientists toy with is high up in the atmosphere. And we're talking 150,000, 200,000 feet up, where you start to get more Earth-like temperatures and conditions. So maybe you could have microbes floating on the wind that actually survive there. So it's a long shot, but maybe.
Now, Bruce, I have read some scientists say that that we should look to Venus as the true potential impacts of climate change. What lessons does Venus hold for us when it comes to climate change?
Well, it's an extreme case because it completely lost the oceans, and then it lost the main way that carbon dioxide is sequestered, that's tied up in rocks, so it's not filling your atmosphere. So the Venus atmosphere is mostly carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide, famously a greenhouse gas. Visible light can get in, but has infrared heat has trouble getting out, so you raise these temperatures and get very, very hot. So that's the same type of thing we're seeing on Earth in a more subtle but nonetheless serious effect with climate change and rising temperatures on the Earth. So it's an extreme cautionary tale of what happens when climate change goes truly wacky.
Now, Bruce, earlier mentioned how NASA feels that they can pull this off, two missions to Venus, and that technology is obviously very much ahead of what we had back in 1990 with Magellan. So what's the game plan logistically for NASA to make this work?
Well, you've got one of the missions is an orbiter with a synthetic aperture radar that sees through the clouds. That's the other catch with Venus is with our eyes, we wouldn't see anything from above the cloud layer. But with radar, you can see through it. That's what Magellan did. And also, there's certain parts of the infrared spectrum that you can actually see through the atmosphere. So the Veritas spacecraft out of JPL is going to have a radar and infrared bands. And then the Da Vinci Plus mission out of NASA Goddard Space Flight Center will have an orbiter with some instrumentation, but it also has an atmospheric probe. So this is a pressure vessel, its own kind of protected submarine, spherical submarine equivalent that will descend on parachutes and then basically drift down through the thick atmosphere while taking all sorts of information about the detailed chemistry of the atmosphere, the surface, even giving us images, highest resolution, true images that we've ever seen. And so it's the key with that one is to either have high temperature things that survive high temperatures or hide your things that'll melt inside your pressure vessel that has controlled temperatures.
That's what I can't wait to see, the pictures. We're talking to Bruce Betts of the Planetary Society. Bruce, while we got you, it's been just over 100 days for Mars NASA Perseverance rover. You'd be a better judge than me on this. Has it been a success for NASA on Mars?
Oh, definitely. It's been working extremely well. They've landed in a very geologically interesting area. They will be doing the over the next few years, they will be exploring slowly and carefully and not only doing all sorts of science in place, but also collecting samples that hopefully will be returned by a future sample return mission to Earth, where you can use those, study those samples in laboratories all over the Earth with big giant instruments. You don't need to fit them onto a rover.
You know, Bruce, the Wright brothers flew the first motor-operated plane in 1903. That's 118 years ago. Now we're landing stuff on another planet. And I've always thought in the grand scheme of human accomplishments, going back to fire in the wheel, that this particular point A to B, Kitty Hawk to Mars, is just kind of a snap of the fingers. What kinds of things, Bruce, if we're having this conversation in 2039, 118 years from now, what kind of things could we be talking about?
2139?
No, 2139. Yeah, 118 years from now.
Well, first of all, we're probably not saying very much, sadly. But I don't know. That's what's exciting about the future. Things change so rapidly in space exploration and technological development that it's hard to even predict for me. I'm particularly bad at predicting the future. But you're going to have much better in situ stuff. Yeah. So things on roving around on worlds, astronauts on at least the moon, maybe off to Mars or at least in those surroundings. And so it's going to be a bright and exciting future.
We'll be talking about it, Bruce, because our brains will be plugged into the Matrix. So our bodies won't be around. Our brains will be alive. That's Bruce Betts, Chief Scientist, Planetary Society. Bruce, thank you very much.
Thank you. I look forward to our brains connecting in 118 years.
More Take Two coming up in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
I'm LA's senior education reporter, Mariana Dale.
The communities that are more marginalized or that do not have access are the ones that are in most need.
I help families understand, navigate, and engage with the forces that shape education from kindergarten through high school.
How do I explain to my daughter that the same day you got to celebrate a birthday, you got to celebrate the day your mama left?
And I make space for students to tell their own stories.
LAist, independent journalism, fact-based journalism.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and most places you get your podcasts. Sammy Martinez. The LA River reopened for recreational activities over the weekend, including kayaking. Now, believe it or not, it's a pretty popular thing to do. Just a few years back, one of our producers, Ari Saperstein, went to find out why. So on this Friday in June, we bring you that story again.
Steve Appleton has led tours for a lot of kayakers on the LA River over the past 6 years.
I can tell you exactly. I don't know the numbers for this year, but up until this year was 7,324.
And as owner of LA River Kayak Safari, he's about to add a few more.
11, 12. Yeah, we got everybody's here. Awesome. How many of you guys have been over in this area before or know anything about it?
Only a couple of people raised their hands.
How many people had somebody make a joke about the fact they're coming to the LA River? Yeah.
Everybody puts a hand up. See, the thing about the LA River is that it's better known for its concrete than its water. For most Angelenos, the river has been concretized their entire life because, well, it's been paved for more than 80 years now, which is part of the reason it's best known as a backdrop for, of all things, car chases in films like Transformers, The Terminator, and Grease.
The rules are there ain't no rules.
If you're used to the car chase scene of the LA River, this section, Elysian Valley, clearly it's not that.
It's hard to imagine now, but in the 1930s, the LA River had too much water in it, and it flooded constantly. So the city paved and deepened the waterway to stop it from overflowing, and it worked. But the LA River, as a natural environment, was decimated. Well, most of it.
Here, they could not pump enough water out of the bottom of this thing, so the bottom in this section does not have concrete on it.
Sure enough, the Elysian Valley section looks more primed for a boat chase than a car chase. It looks like a river. All around, people are fishing, walking along the water, exploring the islands and the river, thanks, in part, to kayaking.
It was about 8 years ago, a group of kayakers paddled the whole LA River. Well, to be clear, they didn't paddle everywhere because sometimes they're pulling their boat through concrete, but they proved the navigability of the river. Within a few years, you're going to be able to go all the way on this path, all the way to the ocean from Canoga Park.
Eventually. Our group is definitely not going to the ocean today. Our short trip starts near Atwater Village, and it ends around the Silver Lake Echo Park border.
So what we're going to do from here is we're going to get helmets on. Try to follow single file.
As the tour begins, the group gets off to a rocky start. Literally. The first quarter mile is pretty shallow, and the guides are constantly helping kayakers whose boats get stuck on rocks.
You guys are good. You guys are really good. Now you're stuck. I'm going to help you. So try to turn down here. Now you're going to get caught. I'm going to turn you over to the right there. There you go. So turn to the right, hard. Turn right. Oh, boy.
Soon enough, we get the hang of it, and we're gliding through the water with ease. But the rocks aren't the only challenge. See, even though we're surrounded by nature, the city is hard to escape.
Right after we launch, we go under the 2 freeway, and you're just starting to engage with some of the bucolic aspects of the river, and looking up, you're seeing cars overhead, and it's quite loud.
But then the cityscape fades away, and natural sounds abound.
There's just a lot of birds down there. Black-crowned night herons, egrets. There are osprey in the river. So the bird sounds are a big one, and there's several little rapids in the river here where we drop down through narrower sections of rock, and it's class 1.5 to 2 little rapids. We can get all people prepped up for that and get them through. See, there's this little white water down there. Head for it and then down that little drop. Sweep with your right hand. Sweep with the right hand.
I mean, class 2 rapids? Not what we were expecting. Getting through them prompts sighs of relief all around.
Oh. Yeah.
And finally, we approach the last stop on our kayaking adventure.
There are some big ponds where the water's as deep as 12, 13 feet deep, and it's very quiet, and it's very remote. It's truly that moment where you're like, what? I'm in the middle of Los Angeles? Could this be possible?
It's true. The absence of city sound, it really is remarkable. Until...
You can do some kayak yoga and stretching. We do have a stretch that we do. You just lean back. Good.
feels really good.
So maybe you can never fully escape the city, but that does not seem to detract from the experience.
I loved it.
That's Emma Ramirez. She's one of the other kayakers on the tour.
Growing up in LA, the idea of a river, that form of recreation being accessible, sounds kind of ridiculous because what everyone knows about the LA River is that most of it is concrete. It felt good to be in water, and I think it felt humbling to be able to do that in the place I call my home.
Kayaking the LA River, it really did feel good. Street traffic, helicopters, and all. For Take Two, I'm Ari Saperstein.
Well, the weekend is finally here, and it's officially Pride Month, so we have some event ideas for you.
I'm KPCC's Itzy Quintanilla. A. Martinez, June is Pride Month, so if you're looking for ways to celebrate, I've got a few events lined up for this weekend and beyond.
All right, start us off.
Well, if you miss live in-person concerts, you can head to the Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum to watch 35 performances over the next 3 days. The event, which is called Out Loud Raising Voices, features performances by queer artists including Hayley Kiyoko, Mickey Blanco, Madame Gandhi, Kim Petras, and more. Tickets are being sold in 2 or 4 seat pods, and if you can't attend in person, the event will also be streaming online for free. Also, if you prefer to stay home this weekend...
Yes, it's I'm old, so I'm going to stay home.
Well, then I have something for you.
Right, good.
Outfest is hosting a 5-day digital festival for all things LGBTQ+ on TV. It's called The Outfronts and includes panel discussions with cast members and creatives from shows like The L Word, Generation Q, and RuPaul's Drag Race. That event is free and available on the streaming channel Outfest Now.
All right, sweet. So we've got concerts and TV wrapped up, but Itzy, you know me, and you know that I'm an artsy kind of dude, and there is an A in art, so give us some art to look at.
Well, tomorrow, the One Archives Foundation opens an outdoor exhibition called Pride Publics, Words and Actions. The foundation says that the exhibition aims to give visibility to LGBTQ life in public, and visitors can view 28 large-scale black and white posters pasted in public spaces in West Hollywood. The exhibition is free with RSVP and runs through Pride Month.
All right, sweet. Now, I think we got the first weekend of Pride covered. What else is going on in LA this weekend?
Well, happening tonight at 6 p.m., the Natural History Museum is presenting its final virtual First Friday of the season. The topic is LA murals. Artists David Flores, LA Commons founder Karen Mack, and Stacey Williams of the USC Architecture and Fine Arts Library will discuss. And finally, the Los Angeles Latino International Film Festival is happening through Sunday. The festival this year is a combination of in-person and virtual events, including films, shorts, music, and more. Tickets for that start at $10 to $15. But that's not all, A. There's still a lot more events happening this weekend and beyond, and our friends here at KPCC and LAist have a whole list of ideas and activities. You can check that out on LAist.com. That's LAIST.com.
That's our own Itzy Quintanilla. Thank you very much.
Thank you, A.
All right, that's going to do it for Take Two this week. You can find me on Twitter at amartinezla. That's at amartinezla. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two is back Monday at 2. Marketplace is next.